My name is Marie Meckel, and I'm here with Deborah Winters, who's a nurse practitioner from New Jersey who works with iTech, and she does some really amazing things. Hello, Deb. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me. So you work for iTech, is that right?
Yes. I work for iTech, University of Washington, and that stands for the International Training and Education for Health, and it'll be 10 years in September.
Wow. So what does iTech do and what do you do for them?
So actually, I'm half-time with iTech, and I'm actually half-time at a private practice here in New Jersey called ID Care. So for iTech, I started out initially the first several years working strictly in Ethiopia, training, identifying nurses who are delivering HIV care, training them with an advanced HIV training, and then following them in their clinics to do some on-site clinical mentoring. Over the last few years, it expanded actually to South Africa, Malawi, Namibia, and in June, actually, I'll be going to China for the first time. So the program has expanded. iTech provides HIV and overall health training, actually, through at about 19 different countries. But like I said, primarily my job has been in Ethiopia and then Malawi, Namibia, and South Africa.
So tell me what you do. I went to one of your trainings. Tell the listeners a little bit about the training.
Yeah, the training, it actually has advanced over the years. It started out with basic HIV training, multidisciplinary. So we actually were the first to develop, in Ethiopia in particular, a multidisciplinary training, which included physicians, pharmacists, and nurses. And at that time, it was, I believe, an 8-day or 10-day training. It was quite long because it included the basics of HIV, including the pharmacology. We did a lot of role-playing, and then there was time in the clinics as well. And over the years, many of the nurses throughout Africa have attended several trainings about basic HIV, and it actually now has advanced to a more complex training. Nurses in particular in South Africa, where I'm working primarily, are the only ones that are in these clinics, and so they have to make these very quick and very complex decision-making about this disease, and it includes also TB and all of the other comorbidities. So we actually now have a quite intense 5-day advanced HIV, TB HIV training. And it's case-based. It uses a workbook, very little PowerPoints, and it really does allow for the nurses to look at case studies and look at cases that are in particular familiar to them, because they're developed based on, clients and patients in South Africa. And they look at these complex cases and answer questions and work as a group. And throughout the 5 days, the cases get more complex, and they include not only HIV, like I said, but TB, management of TB, MDR-TB and XDR-TB, as well as other comorbidities. So it really has allowed them to go back to their clinics and be able to be more comfortable as far as making these decisions. Following that, we also have mentoring. South Africa has quite a bit of mentoring going on right now from different NGOs. And, we always say that classroom training is just a piece of it. When they get back out to their clinics and really see patients with these complex conditions, it's good to have someone who has experience who will be able to guide them through their decision-making. So the mentoring is a very, very critical piece as far as training is concerned.
So tell me about the mentoring. Like, how many times do you go out? How do you know if they understand? Like, tell me about the mentoring.
Yeah, so the mentoring, as I mentioned before, the mentoring now is being done by several different NGOs throughout South Africa, as well as the South African Department of Health nurses as well. So they have a small, a catchment area of clinics, within a smaller area, and they're responsible for providing on-site mentoring and teaching to the nurses and the staff at those clinics. They determine, based on the staff, based on, the needs of the staff, how often they actually are needed. And the staff, it's a feedback. It's back and forth depending on the mentee, the nurse's needs. A more experienced nurse may not need as much one-on-one mentoring as someone who's brand new. And they also provide very critical distance mentoring and distance consultation. So if a nurse is out there and she has a question or has a problem, she can always reach that mentor by phone. The mentoring, though, is done in South Africa in particular. They use guidelines. They use tools to assess the mentees, to assess the staff, in particular when they're, you know, providing the care. And, you know, again, they base their follow-up on the needs of that particular staff member. So it's very, very much individualized. But in particular, you know, there's been a recognition that this is such a critical piece to get that nurse, you know, comfortable with making these decisions. She always has the opportunity to consult with her physician mentor. So there's a physician that's assigned to these clinics as well to help these staff, you know, with more complex cases, or if the patient needs to be seen and evaluated by the physician. So that staff nurse has not only the nurse mentor, but a physician mentor and a team of people that she can rely on. We, you know, at ITech support those mentors by what we call a mentor of mentors program. So my role in particular, I'll go out with these mentors of, you know, of the NGO or the Department of Health, and I'll watch them and evaluate them and assess them as they are providing mentoring to the staff. And because I've been doing HIV for 26 years, I have quite a bit of experience, and I can guide that mentor to particular needs or a way to be able to have a mentee absorb and perform, you know, better, you know, as far as what she's doing, based on, you know, experiences that I've had. So my role right now in particular is to support the mentors as well as the mentees.
That's a really nice way of doing it. And I really like how you're involving the Department of Health in South Africa. Tell me how that's going.
Very well, actually. It's amazing, you know, when I've met these nurses, and I work in Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, you know, different areas. And, you know, the Department of Health had, you know, identified, again, that there was a need for this support. And the mentors were started, but, you know, they really weren't as comfortable or familiar with what a mentor really is. And, you know, people do think, okay, well, I sort of know what I'm supposed to do. But then when you get out there, it's like, well, how do you, you know, provide the support, and how do you allow that mentee to change, you know, the way that they maybe are providing care, identify, you know, some of the things that are like what I call red flags, you know, when we're dealing with HIV. So, you know, I found that they were in particular looking to me for, okay, what is the job of a mentor? You know, and I basically said to them, you know, you're a coach, you know, you're a friend, you know, you're a counselor, you're all of these pieces, along with the fact that you are considered, the way, you know, the reason why you were hired as a mentor is that you're an expert in your field. You've gotten the experience yourself from either a clinic or from teaching. And so you need to provide that mentee with that experience and that support that you have gotten and you've developed over the years. So it's been very interesting, you know, and I tell them over and over again, the easiest thing right now with HIV care in particular, because, you know, most countries, in particular South Africa, they have, you know, the one pill once a day. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to start prescribing these medications. The most difficult part of HIV care is keeping patients on these medications and keeping them healthy. And that requires so much time and energy and support that the mentees have to give to these patients, along with everything else that they're responsible for in the clinics. And so I find that the mentor right now, that his role is really to support that nurse to keep going and to keep providing the care, to find those patients that have defaulted and get them back into care. That's the most difficult part. And I think that's where the mentor's role is very, very important, to really support these nurses in this very difficult job.
When I met you before, you were talking to me about defaulting on medications, and a lot of the clinical associates talk about it. Tell us a little bit about the effect of defaulting on the medications, the reasons you think. Like, what have you learned through the whole thing?
Oh, what I've learned. It is so difficult. It's so complex. You know, human nature, behavior, you know, substance use. I do find now that alcohol and substance use, you know, the nurses are really talking to me about the challenges of dealing with those patients. And, you know, here in New Jersey, that's what I deal with all the time. You know, it's very, very difficult. And certainly there are not AA or, you know, a lot of alcohol support groups that, you know, nurses can refer these patients to. So defaulting, you know, is really just a complexity of reasons that, you know, that people, you know, just, you know, this disease is difficult to deal with, you know, and sometimes, you know, patients are in denial, or, you know, they don't even believe the fact that they're HIV positive. Or I find that when patients are very, very sick, we get them on the medicines. These medicines, you know, medications are incredible. People start feeling well, you know, almost immediately. Well, as soon as somebody feels well, you know, that's where denial comes back and just behavior takes over. So they feel like, you know, I don't really need this pill, and I'm feeling fine, and I'm tired of taking it. So they stop. Or in particular, what I find in South Africa, you have a very migrant population. If you have a farm that has, you know, doesn't have the work in this particular area, they're going to go to another farm to be able to get the work, or another mine. So they may not think about the fact of, oh, I need to find a clinic, you know, who's going to refill my medication that's going to be out tomorrow. And, you know, defaulting also, in particular with South Africa, is an extremely difficult and very concerning problem because of tuberculosis. So, you know, if you're not only defaulting with your HIV medicines, but also with your TB medicines, therein lies, you know, the complexity of dealing with these patients and how sick they can be. And also, you know, the fact of, you know, spreading not only tuberculosis, but also HIV. So I find, again, going back to that mentee and that staff nurse, she needs the support to be able to deal with these patients that she knows should be seen, you know, today or last week, and she can't find them. But, you know, she just doesn't know how to go about, or doesn't have the support services to be able to go out and find all of these patients. I found over the last several, probably year or two, a lot of my messaging has been to this staff is that, you know, if we really look at keeping patients on these medications, keeping them engaged in care, in fact, what you're going to find is that your clinic load, you know, your patient load is going to lessen. You're going to have many patients. The community viral load and the community tuberculosis problem will, in fact, be lessened if we can keep patients on these medications and keep them healthy. So, you know, we try, but it is extremely difficult.
So you can evaluate, you can, like, make a statement about a community by having a community viral load?
Absolutely. If you have, you know, so many patients that are within your community that you know of that are HIV positive, and we know now that you know, in South Africa in particular, the CD4 count, the way we put, or the time we put patients on medications is based on their immune system. Well, if we get those patients that are qualified, that are eligible on those medications, and their viral load, the amount of virus that's actually in their body, becomes undetectable, and that's the term we use, and in fact they're healthy, if we keep them on that medication and keep their viral load undetectable, we now know that they are less likely to transmit the virus, even if they're not continuing to use safer sex practices. That, in fact, we have research now that shows that, in fact, the HIV is less likely to be transmitted if someone is on their medication and if their viral load, which is detected by blood, is what we call undetectable. Well, if you have, you know, within that, again, community, the number of patients that are on medicines with an undetectable viral load, your community viral load, in fact, is going to be lower. You're going to have less transmission of virus within your community. And that also goes hand-in-hand with tuberculosis as well. So I talk about the community viral load because, again, it's going to help that nurse who's the only one in that clinic, you know, delivering care to that community.
What can the nurse do to, I know you've talked about a lot of the challenges. What can they do, or what can the Department of Health do with them to help increase adherence? Is there anything?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this, you know, especially as I've gone to many, many of the rural areas. And again, my messaging has changed. You know, I've tried to, you know, become more, you know, creative when it comes to dealing with this nurse. So I'm looking in her eyes and I'm seeing quite a lot of burnout and being very tired. And what I've actually said to them is, you know, we need to start involving more the community. If we get community leaders, if we get patients that are on the medications, doing what they're told, are healthy, if we can get them to speak out and maybe develop a small support group, as well as knowing where patients are are that maybe have defaulted, if we can involve the community, it's going to help the nurse because she can't do it alone. Nor can the Department of Health do it alone. There's only so much manpower that we have within the healthcare community. So we need to look at the community leaders and the community themselves for help and support within their own clinic. And I think that's what's probably going to be needed more than ever, because I can't create new nurses. You know, we can't necessarily put another nurse in the clinic when, in fact, you know, there are constraints, both financial as well as, well, you know, the other problems. So, you know, we need to be creative with this. And my only thought comes back to the village themselves and the community themselves.
Has anyone looked into community health workers or anything?
There are community health workers, but again, they are short supply.
Oh.
And the more we have these defaulters, and I will tell you, the defaulting numbers vary depending on what area I've been to. But to me, when I ask the defaulting rate, and they, you know, they do track this, it's either the same as maybe a couple of years ago, or in fact, it's gone up. So in fact, if you have more and more people that are defaulting, and you have two or three community health workers, again, they can only do so much. They can only do so much. So I think that's where we have to really look outside the box and start, you know, and I said to many of the nurses over this last year, you need to open your mouth. You need to be vocal and say to your leaders, look, I need help. And maybe that will be an approach.
It sounds overwhelming.
It is, I think, but I don't think it's impossible. I really do think, you know, and, you know, look, I'm not going to deny that there is still stigma and discrimination. It is alive and well, and I hear stories all the time. But I think what we need to do is start, you know, looking beyond that and saying, look, what else can we do here? If I'm doing the best that I can, you tell me as a community, what else can I do to help keep our area, our community, and our village healthy?
When I talked to you before, you talked a little bit about how defaulting really leads to increased risks of more drug-resistant HIV and TB. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, along with the fact of having the frustration of having defaulting, we also have a very serious clinical outcome. So we now know, you know, and this is 30 years of HIV, you know, history and experience that we have behind us, but there is no cure. But we know that the medicines work, and we know that the medicines, in fact, again, keep someone healthy. We have what we call an undetectable viral load, you know, that's measured in the blood. What happens when someone starts missing medication? And that could be one pill a week. It could be two pills a week. It depends on everyone, you know, the individual genetics of that person. But when you start missing these medications, this virus is a very dumb virus, but it's also a very smart virus at the same time. The virus actually can detect the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of medicine here that's protecting, you know, the immune system. I, in fact, have a window here of opportunity to make different kinds of copies and, in fact, mutations to the medications that this person is taking. So what happens is this person's missing on a Friday night or a Saturday night because they, you know, got drunk or, you know, they're high and they forget to take their medicine. And over time, this virus can, in fact, develop mutations and copies and errors. So, in fact, the medicine stopped working. Now, people tell me all the time, well, how long is it going to take or how many pills do I have to miss? Again, there's no way to tell. Each person has their individual genetics. And so, again, people can develop mutations and resistance to the medicine in a matter of months. Other people can take a matter of a year or two, but it does happen. If people miss medications with this virus, in fact, the medications will stop working. And the problem with that is there are only so many medications that we have in South Africa. And in fact, the one pill once a day, which is the standard right now, that's what everyone goes on who's newly diagnosed HIV positive and who in fact is eligible for medication. Once they have become resistant to that one pill once a day, the next set of medications that we have are more difficult. There's more side effects. effects. Mm. There are more pills to take. So we tell patients all the time, look, this one pill once a day is gold. You could stay on this for a very long time, years and years, if you don't miss any doses. And that's 100% adherence. So in fact, if we have resistance with these medications in a certain area, in a community, or within a country, in fact, people that are newly infected, so let's say they're getting infected tonight, could be in fact infected with the resistant virus. So in fact, that one pill once a day may not even work for them. And they have to go to that, what we call the second line medication. So it's not only a problem for the patient, because resistant virus, again, if you have a virus, HIV virus, that is not controlled, you're more at risk of developing problems, of developing complications, of developing TB. But you also have that added problem and challenge of having resistance within a community and resistance within the country. So it's a big problem. And this is global. This is not just South Africa. Here in the United States, we have a significant problem with resistance because people started and stopped, and, you know, they take their medicines and they don't take their medicines. So, in fact, their adherence is not 100%, and that's where it has developed.
Is anyone measuring these rates? Like, is it worse in South Africa as opposed to the United States?
Well, it's hard to measure at this point. There are now areas in South Africa, in some of the larger cities, that have the machines and the capability of testing for resistance. In fact, we have ways, and we've taught the nurses this, you know, this aspect of HIV care in our training, is how to identify someone who is failing that one pill once a day, and then what to do, you know, what are the steps taken. And the South African guidelines are very specific on what to do. So the nurses have been taught how to do this. Once they get into, you know, if they failed that first-line regimen, there are places that can, you know, detect the resistance in particular, but it's very specialized and it's very costly. So right now we don't have really an accurate number of people that are resistant. We know, I mean, we're capturing that in each of the communities, the number of people that have failed first-line, what we call first-line, and that's the one pill once a day, and then are in second-line. And we're watching those numbers very carefully. So they range from province to province. But we do know that it's out there. And the other problem that I see, you know, when I'm visiting these clinics is that when they're talking to me about the number of patients that have defaulted, in my own experience, in my own mind, I already know that that patient most likely has become resistant. So, you know, it's just something that we are aware of right now. We're trying to get a handle on it. And you know, in fact, you know, the nurses that are seeing these patients newly diagnosed are doing a lot of patient teaching about adherence and making sure they understand how important it is for themselves as well as their community and their partners to make sure that they're taking their pills.
Wow. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is that I've heard a lot about how the clinics don't have the medications, and then I heard that they just don't order them in time. Do you have any idea, or can you comment on the availability of the medications?
You know, honestly, all the clinics that I've been to, and I've been to many in South Africa, I have not, you know, really seen a what we call a stock out of the medication.
Oh.
The supply is there. You know, they do have, you know, the first line medicines that I talked about. They also have in supply the second line. If somebody has failed that one pill once a day, they have the second line medicines available. If there is stock out, it usually is a fact of ordering, you know, or the fact that they've had more patients than they expected, you know, at a certain period of time. Also along with that is the pediatric dosing as well. So, you know, I do ask about, you know, do you have enough medicines for the pediatric patients? The medications are there. The challenge has been with pediatric HIV is getting pediatric patients tested and also getting them on the medications, getting the nurses comfortable with dealing with pediatric patients. And I will tell you, in our trainings, we really have focused quite a lot on the pediatric HIV positive patient and having staff comfortable with identifying identifying and treating those patients. The mentoring also has really focused on working with the nurses on increasing the number of pediatric patients that are on medicines as well. So that's been an area. But I will tell you, you know, the stockout issue, I have not come across as much as now, as much as years ago. Certainly years ago, there was quite a bit of stockout and problems with accessing, you know, medication. But I haven't seen that over the last couple of years.
I couldn't figure out what was, if it was real or not. Like, I read articles about it, but some, you know, some nurses tell me it's fine, and other ones say it's a problem. So I was confused.
Yeah, no, I really, you know, we South Africa had changed over to a new medication called tenofovir, and when before that, you know, really started, there was quite a bit of shortage of medication. I'm talking years ago, but in fact, you know, that has, like I said, that really has changed over the last year. South Africa has what's called FDC, which is called the fixed dose combination, and that's the one pill once a day that the new patient, newly diagnosed HIV patient, is going to be put on.
How many ingredients does that one pill have?
So the HIV virus needs to be treated with three medications. I call them, there's two foundation medicines and then one additional medicine. And I always do a picture of a house. You know, you have two medicines that are the foundation, the cement of a house. And then the house can be either what we call a protease inhibitor or a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. The FDC has a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor called Efavirenz. Atripla is the U.S. name, sorry. Efavirenz. And then the foundation medicine, the cement of the house, is tenofovir and what we call FDC. So each of that one pill has three medicines included in it. And that's been the beauty part of research over the last few years, is that research and pharmaceutical companies have really been aggressively working on putting three medicines into one or two pills. Because we know, based on research and a lot of history about treating other diseases, the less pills a person takes, the better off they are with adherence. So that's why the one pill once a day, and it's taken at night, is the ideal, because, you know, patients do better if there's only one pill.
Are other countries using it? Do we use it in the United States?
Yes, we do. Atripla is the name that's called in the United States. And actually, most countries that I see and that I read about now have access to the FDC, the fixed dose combination, because, again, it just makes it a lot easier for patients.
That's amazing. So you were telling me a little bit about you going to China. Tell me about your trip. Tell me about HIV in China.
Well, yeah, China is going to be new for me. We've been working ITEC with the CDC in China for the last couple of years. And in fact, we provided a physician course, a comprehensive advanced HIV training for physicians in China. And that was about a year or so ago. And we've been actively discussing with them providing a nursing training. So we were finally asked, you know, to do this in a formal way. They've asked for actually a two-week training that includes a practicum. So let me just go back a bit. So in Ethiopia, when we started initially, so that's 10 years ago, we developed the advanced training for nurses that included a practicum. Because again, the classroom is just, you can just do so much in a classroom. It really is best to be out in a clinic, you know, and actually see patients. So China had asked for a training that's similar to that. So it will be, when it's rolled out, it will be a two-week training with a practicum. I'm going in June to actually do a pilot. So we're going to condense it to 6 days, which will be the didactic, you know, the classroom part of the training, so that they get an idea of what the training involves. And then I'll also do a TOT, what's called the training of trainers. So after this initial 6-day training, they're going to pull together a group of expert trainers. And what I'm going to do for them is a training of trainers. So it'll be the actual HIV curriculum, but I'll also focus on, you know, just some training, advanced training techniques. how to engage an audience, how to, you know, to really look at the role plays and some of the exercises that we're going to be doing in the training. And so following that, we hope that the actual nursing training will be rolled out. Hopefully I'll get to go back, and that will also include the practicum. So this trip will not include the practicum. I will get to see a clinic, though, just to give me an idea, since I'm not familiar with the China clinic and the China healthcare system. So it's going to be new for me after 10 years of Africa. This is going to be quite an experience.
And you were telling me before, why are HIV rates going up in China?
Well, they you know, it's been an area, a pandemic that, in fact, was primarily fueled by substance use, IV drug use, but it now, in fact, has become more heterosexual transmission, which we see, you know, certainly in HIV. So the heterosexual numbers have increased. They have, in fact, instituted an aggressive substance use policy and program that also includes a needle exchange, methadone program. So they really have aggressively looked at dealing with the substance use problem. And also included in that is, providing for and encouraging and doing patient education about safer sex practices. So, in fact, trying to, to really halt and slow down the transmission rate. With this, though, you know, the nursing training is so important because the nurses are the ones that are dealing with these patients on a more regular basis. As I mentioned, we did an aggressive advanced physician training. But now with the nurses, we're going to be dealing with not only substance use and some of the techniques of dealing with that population, but also stigma and discrimination, dealing with families, communication. Again, adherence, along with basic HIV training. So they really have, looked at this problem very seriously and aggressively and really want to get a handle on it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. I've done quite a bit of reading, about the last few years and what they have instituted, and it's quite impressive.
You would tell me a little bit about going to Ethiopia for the first time. Tell me about the beginning of your work in doing this and what your experience in Ethiopia was like.
Oh, well, so I had, it's 10 years ago. So I was doing HIV probably for about 15 plus years by the time I got the first phone call. So I had a colleague of mine, that was called she was just somehow found out, through the University of Washington with her work in HIV. President Bush initially had awarded University of Washington the original PEPFAR monies to look at training in many, many African countries. And so iTech was born, and that's like 12 years ago, actually, and the University of Washington was awarded this initial set of monies. And so what their focus was to look at these countries and see what the problem was and see how they could address as far as, training is concerned. And so she got the call to go to Ethiopia and called me, to accompany her. So our initial meeting and our initial trip was really we were told to go find the nurses that are delivering HIV care. And it was incredible. I mean, we went to some military hospitals. We went to some generalized university-based hospitals in Addis Ababa, which is the capital of Ethiopia. And we found nurses that were, delivering HIV care. But at the time, this was before the medication was even in Ethiopia. People that were on medicine at that time were actually getting it underground.
Wow.
Or getting it from the U.S. or from Canada. And they had money, of course. Those are the people that were getting the medicines. And so we were actually there when the first government program was started for free medication. But prior to that, we developed, as I said, this multidisciplinary training. We based it on the trainings that we had done here in the U.S. And so, again, my colleague and I had been doing HIV care even here in the U.S. before the medicines were started. I started with the original 019 ACT clinical trials. So this was before the ACT was even available, to patients here in the United States. So we had all of this experience of 15 years of, knowing what it was, that in fact one medication was not enough, and the birth of using two medicines, as well as the final, what we call the cocktail, which was the mid-1990s, and knowing that this virus needed three different medications in order to keep it quiet, knowing how to deal with the infections that were, you know, common to people with HIV. So we just, you know, shared that in a training to nurses, physicians, and pharmacists in Ethiopia. And the government just, you know, took the training and just rolled it out, you know, throughout the country. And in fact, I guess after about 2 years or so, because Ethiopia is so large, other partners came into the country. So Columbia University was awarded a grant to deal with HIV and training and mentoring in the southern part of Ethiopia. Johns Hopkins was awarded a grant to look at HIV care in the central part of the country, Addis and some of the areas surrounding that. And then ITEC, we were asked to provide the training and the care in the north. So in fact, my area was in Axum, in Ababwa, and as well as in the northern part of Ethiopia on the west. So there were three different areas that we were you know, given the grant to provide the care and training.
That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, it was, because we saw, you know, from the basics of training, we saw, again, the advanced HIV nursing training that was developed, which was called HANS, HIV ART specialty nurse. That training actually was developed and also expanded to other countries. Zimbabwe has a HANS program, Zambia, Uganda. You know, they just looked at that training and practicum piece and developed it within their own countries because it was so successful. And then, you know, over the years, I just watched these nurses just evolve and develop into just competent, experienced, advanced practice nurses. And, you know, so in fact, in these clinic areas where there's only one nurse, she or he is the one that's providing the care, you know, the total care for these patients. So it really was quite an experience to watch this develop. And South Africa developed, you know, the same thing over the years. So we're watching the same thing happen there.
I've met a few Malawi medical associates, and I didn't realize how influential, I mean, how much impact they had on lowering HIV rates. Did you end up working with them at all? I know you were in Malawi.
In Malawi?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Malawi, so Malawi was the first country to develop what we call Option B+. So that is a program, and that actually, again, has taken off to all the countries. We know that these medicines work not only for somebody who's HIV positive, but also in prevention. So in fact, we had an original clinical trial back probably in the early 1990s, where we had pregnant women that were taking these medications. And in fact, their babies were born HIV negative. And so we've known this research, we know it works. And in fact, in the U.S., the rate of transmission from a mother to a baby is less than 1%. Here in New Jersey, we have not seen an HIV positive baby in years. And so in Malawi, you know, this research was developed, and in fact, you know, Malawians were seeing the same thing, but they developed this program called Option B+. And so any woman who is pregnant in Malawi, and again, in other countries as well, they're given an HIV test, offered an HIV test. And in fact, if they're HIV positive, they're put on medication immediately. It does not matter what their immune system is, similar to what I said before. In South Africa, with somebody who's HIV positive, who's not pregnant, the starting of medicine is based on a number called the CD4, and that's a cell actually in our body that helps prevent us from getting infection. But with an HIV-positive pregnant woman, it doesn't matter what her immune system is. She goes on medication immediately because we know that that's going to prevent that baby from becoming HIV-positive. And Option B+ is that even when she delivers, after she delivers that baby and after she finishes breastfeeding, she is going to stay on that medication, on the HIV medication, because in fact, it's going to keep her healthy. And if she gets pregnant again, it's going to prevent her second baby or third baby from acquiring the virus as well. So they have had incredible results from putting pregnant women on medication. And in fact, they have lowered the number of HIV positive babies within that country significantly. So it's just incredible to watch.
Are they using that medication in South Africa, the option B plus?
They're using the medication, their option B, it's called option B, only because in South Africa, yes, a woman who's pregnant is offered an HIV test. If she is positive, she goes on medication, does not matter what her immune system or her CD4 count, actually what that number is, she goes on medication. Once she delivers, and once she finishes breastfeeding, because again, that virus can be transmitted through breast milk, they're going to retest her immune system, her CD4 count. And based on that, if her immune system is very healthy and her CD4 count is very high, she in fact will be taking off the medication at this point. Now, there's a lot of discussion going on as far as changing the guideline and making it more along the lines of what Malawi is doing. But there's discussions going on about that right now. The immune system is a very protective and very strong system within our body. And in fact, if her numbers are very high, she in fact could be fine and remain healthy without medication. So that's going to be based on, you know, the physician that sees her or the nurse that's evaluating her and based on her numbers. But if she's pregnant and if she's positive, she's going to go on medication right away.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing, because I will tell you, one of the things that has made me smile, you know, even with all the challenges of delivering HIV care, is the fact of, you know, initially in my work in Ethiopia, when they would bring me to the pediatric units or want me to work with the pediatric nurses, all I saw, you know, was bed after bed of HIV positive babies and children. Now, when I go to a pediatric unit, I don't see that as much. I'm seeing malaria, I'm seeing malnutrition, but I'm not seeing HIV positive as much. And that just puts a smile on my face, because there, you know, we've done something.
The pediatric HIV cases you see in South Africa, are they all transmission through childbirth or, yeah?
Primarily, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yeah. I mean, you know, you have those cases of children that, you know, unfortunately are raped, and that's an unfortunate situation. But the cases that you see of the babies and the young children who are HIV positive are from birth or, from breastfeeding.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about the high incident of rape, and I was wondering if that contributed to that.
Yeah. Oh, it's just, yeah, it's an unfortunate, you know, very sad situation, and one that I know communities are aggressively looking at trying to quell.
If you have one message that you want the world to know about you, your work, or HIV, what would it be? What do you want to tell everybody?
Oh, I guess it's just been a privilege for me. I mean, I will tell you, I have learned more from my colleagues in Africa than I could ever imagine. And I bring that back here to the U.S. I will tell people, I tell stories all the time of the strength and the dedication and the commitment and just the brilliance of our nurse colleagues, you know, in all of the African countries that I've worked. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with them. I've learned from them. You know, I hope I've been able to give them at least some strength and some encouragement, you know, when it comes to dealing with this virus. But I'm also very conscious about the fact that one nurse or two nurses, when I pull up to a clinic where there are 50 to 100 people waiting for them, with all the complexities of other diseases, and I come along and, you know, try to talk to them about why it's so important to have these patients stay on their medications, you know, I'm very conscious of the fact that they are all alone and the support that they need. So I want to let them know that I know that, I understand that, and I would like to make it better for them. But hopefully just by me patting them on the back or giving them a hug or encouraging them for the good work that they're doing, that they're able to continue.
Thank you very much for taking time to talk to me. You do amazing work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.